Velocity Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Jordan Calhoun, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And first, let us just say Happy New Year.
Yes, we are so happy to have made it to 2021. How you feeling, Alice?
Oh my God, I'm amazing. I mean, nothing bad can ever happen again because 2020 is done. And yeah, we're good now, right?
That's what I'm telling myself.
But seriously, thank you all for sticking with us. We have so many plans for upgrading your lives in 2021. And to start us off, we are tackling the power of suggestion.
That's right. And we're learning how to use things like the placebo effect and hypnosis to our advantage. And we're getting help from science journalist Eric Vance.
Your brain just says, let's just do that. Like, rather than having to reevaluate all the expectations around pills, let's just make the pain go away. And that's basically what the placebo effect is. It's just your brain adjusting reality so that it meets an expectation.
Eric is an award-winning science writer and a staff editor for the New York Times Well section. His work has appeared in outlets like Harper's Magazine, the New York Times, Scientific American, and National Geographic.
In 2016, Eric published Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal.
So, Jordan, we are talking in the episode about the power of hypnosis and placebo and just basic suggestibility. Where would you put yourself in terms of being suggestible or not?
I would put myself in the extreme category of being not hypnotizable and unsuggestible and sort of resistant to the whole idea of it. Like, I feel like I'm so skeptical and perhaps cynical that those type of things would be difficult for me to sort of accept and wrap my mind around. And I think, to be completely honest, that that is partially based in fear of those things. Like, I feel like it would be, oh man, I don't know how to describe it. I would feel some type of way if I was hypnotizable or if I was, you know, suggestible in some significant way. I feel like it would be some type of indictment on the strength of my mind or something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, no, I can see that. I can see that with you. I'm, you know, I wanted to take this time to analyze you and really get into your psyche because, no, but I do think like you're the kind of person, you've got like really like strong boundaries.
Right.
I can see that in you. Like you're a very like, this is me and this is you, where I'm much more porous, let's say. Definitely way more suggestible. We will get into my hypnosis story during the episode. But yeah, I think I'm pretty much the opposite when it comes to hypnosis. And I could probably just take nothing but placebos all the time, I think, if the logic holds.
Man, I'm just realizing this sort of as we're talking it through, but I think I take sort of a weird or maybe misplaced pride in being unsuggestible, like in not being like so easily influenced. I feel like that's...
Yeah, no, I think that's good.
Yeah.
I don't think that's misplaced.
Okay.
I think you should be thinking about,
I'm sort of having a mild crisis right now, thinking of like, is that good or does that mean that I'm actually just stubborn and closed-minded? Like, where do you draw the line between, you know, being stubborn and closed-minded or actually being open to, you know, what could be positive influence?
Yes. I think there's a balance to be struck and maybe you're a little bit to one side of it. But I think I'm like all the way on to other side of it. And, you know, there needs to be a happy medium where I'm just like, let me take your life completely into my life and, you know, just be like an empath to a ridiculous degree. So I wouldn't say your pride is misplaced. It sounds pretty great to me.
It sounds like
you're just a smarter person.
I don't know. I imagine between you and I on the extremes, there has to be a happy medium. And I'm looking forward to talking with Eric to find what that happy medium might be.
Excellent. Let's do it. So Eric, welcome to The Upgrade.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us, first of all, about your book, Suggestible You. How did you come to write it and what inspired that?
I guess it really goes back to the fact that my upbringing was in Christian Science. And I don't know if you or your listeners know what that is. It's really a shrinking religion in a lot of places. But basically, Christian Scientists don't go to doctors. They believe in faith healing. It's sort of I always describe it as kind of like the Matrix, where like basically they sort of believe that they can control their bodies and sort of the world around them with their mind. And so it's kind of a weird way to grow up. Try explaining that to your third grade show and tell class, that this is all a mental construct. And so as an adult, I left Christian Science, but I was always very curious about what it was that allowed me as a kid to heal myself, or to at least feel relief from, you know, colds and pain and different things when I prayed about it. And it all started actually when I went to a brain mapping conference and recognized a fellow Christian Scientist giving a keynote address about placebos. And that sent me down this massive rabbit hole about belief and expectation and how that works in the brain. That led me to a lot of different really interesting areas in which expectation and belief affect your body. And that's where the book came from.
I'm really interested in the power of placebos. And normally when I think about placebos, I think of, so I almost have this knee-jerk reaction whenever someone is sick and they want to reach for airborne or vitamin C or what's the other pop, emergency or something like that. And I'm like, that really doesn't do anything for your illness. I'm like, my sort of is probably super obnoxious. Like my reaction being, don't go for those things. They're just a waste. To which a lot of people respond like, well, the placebo effect isn't nothing. Like it is having an impact. How powerful is the placebo effect in someone's perceptions of pain or their own illness?
It's a great question. The answer is actually really interesting because it can be incredibly powerful, but not for everything. And that's what makes it so interesting, is there are some conditions like pain where it is incredibly powerful, where your brain has a lot of leeway to change its experience around pain. And then you look at something like cancer or obsessive compulsive disorder. And for whatever reason, or Alzheimer's is another one, the brain doesn't have a lot of access to monkey with these conditions or to change these conditions. So you don't see big placebo effects. So there are some conditions, and the classic ones are pain, irritable bowel syndrome, depression, anxiety, some autoimmune diseases, and maybe addiction. There's a couple others in there that I'm probably forgetting. Oh, Parkinson's is a big one, that have huge placebo responses. So when you see products that rely on placebos, they often target those conditions. But then you look at other things and they don't. And a lot of it has to do with brain chemistry and what your brain is able to do in terms of the tools it has on hand. And so that's why for some people, and it also isn't equal across different people. Some people have very strong placebo responses, some people don't. It changes. It's been really a moving target for science for a long time. And that's why some of us are just say like, oh, you're just wasting your time. And other people say, no, this really works. Because for them, it might, depending on their condition and the way their brain works.
So is there a way to use the placebo effect? Because if we know we're using the placebo effect, doesn't that negate
right.
the usefulness of it? Aren't we then like onto our, we're being tricked? We can't trick ourselves,
your
right?
Oddly enough,
your brain doesn't care what you think.
Really?
Your brain will. Well, really? There's two kinds of placebo effects. And I know we want to talk about hypnosis, and these things actually are tied together a little bit. But there are two kinds of placebos. And one of them is a conscious placebo, where I just tell you this great story about this new nutrient or some new berry or something that harnesses the sun's rays and, you know, and lets them rebound off of your ribs and then go up through your head. And you're just, wow, you get really into it. And then you have this placebo effect when you try it. That's one. The other one is an unconscious placebo, where every time you take a little blue pill or every time you take a little triangle white pill, you feel better. And that just happens throughout your whole life. And then one day someone gives you the exact same thing, but it doesn't have anything in it. And you take it and you feel better. You can't, even if someone tells you that's a placebo and explains to you what a placebo is, that effect still might happen. And they've done this experiment many times where they say, this is a placebo, explain to the subjects what it is, and they take it and they still feel better because their body just doesn't care what you're thinking. It's like, look, this is what's going to happen when you take this pill. And rather than have to adjust its whole perception of what a pill is for, it's just like, you know what? It's just easier if we make the pain go away so that reality matches expectation. Your brain just says, let's just do that. Like rather than having to reevaluate all the expectations around pills, let's just make the pain go away. And that's basically what the placebo effect is. It's just your brain adjusting reality so that it meets an expectation.
So I'm just wrapping my head around this. So if I'm taking the same medication every day for 20 years, could I just get a sugar pill now and not have to pay money to big pharma?
That would be a great experiment. Yeah, a lot of people do have that experience. If you wanted to even be more clever, what you would do, and this is actually something that they do with soldiers who are coming back from, I shouldn't say they, there's a scientist at Walter Reed who has done this very successfully, where soldiers coming back from the battlefield who've lost limbs, they give them the pain drugs, but then in addition to that, they actually give them a sensory experience, which might be, in his case, the examples he used were like the sound of jazz, the smell of eucalyptus, or those little Werther's caramels that, like, for some reason only grandparents have. And, you know, and he had different patients who like had these really nice affiliations with these sensory experiences. And basically every time they took their pain drugs, they either listened to jazz or they smelled eucalyptus or they had a little caramel. And over time, what they started doing was cutting back on the drug and still giving the sensory experience. So it's like a little boost. Yes, you know, the act of taking your pill could be enough, but you could also try pairing it with something. And that would be another signal to your brain that, like, look, nothing's changed. Even though you're taking away the drug, you can trick your brain into basically filling in that prescription on its own. They often call your brain the internal pharmacy. And that works especially for something like pain or depression. In fact, there's even a theory that chronic pain is simply your brain not filling its own prescription and making that pain go away with its own drugs. So you're spurring the brain to do what it's supposed to do. That's the theory. And the scientist has had amazing success with the long-term pain related to the loss of limbs because he's tricking people's brains. So yeah, you could do that.
You mentioned hypnotism, and I would love to dive into hypnosis, specifically to ask, what is it? Because when I think of, I guess it sort of seems silly, but like when I think of hypnosis, I have a very, how do I describe it? Like I almost picture an episode of Saved by the Bell where this sociopath, Zach Morris, like hypnotizes women to go on dates with him. Or like, you see a lot of things
that's
in pop
very,
culture.
That's a very, very specific association.
I was just saying the same thing.
I think of Zach Morris when I think of hypnosis or suggestibility because he like used this secret message to get all these girls to like get things for him. And I think that was early in my impressionable young years. That was pop culture was my early introduction to what hypnosis would mean. Someone like dangling a clock in front of your face and saying you are getting sleepy, or having Zach Morris put a subliminal message to get a date. So those are the two things that I think of. What is hypnosis in an actual sort of practical scientific sense?
First of all, I was kind of hoping you would tell me because actually no one knows for sure. But apparently I should be watching more Saved by the Bell.
I'll point you to 90s pop culture. So I don't know if I have a good answer.
You'll never get steered wrong by Saved by the Bell.
I mean, it's a great question. And the short answer is we don't know. But I can tell you what it's not. And one thing we know for sure that it's not is it's not a placebo. Hypnosis and placebo are both related to expectation, but they seem to have different mechanisms. And the reason we know is because there's drugs you can actually, naloxone, basically, that you can give someone while they're having a placebo effect related to pain. And placebo effects are related to, you know, internal opioids that your brain is releasing. Give someone naloxone, that placebo effect goes away and they're in pain again. You do the same thing with someone under hypnosis and it doesn't make the pain go away. The hypnosis pain relief stays no matter whether people have naloxone or not. So hypnosis seems to be something different. You know, for this book, basically, I spent a lot of time looking at alternative forms of medicine or therapies, sort of trying to get to understand what makes our brain give us relief. And hypnosis was one of the few things that I found that is sort of one of these, you know, groovy, new age, sort of crazy things you're not really sure about that actually is real and that actually is a measurable event. And it has, frankly, one of the most fascinating histories I've ever seen. And the big question in my mind is why we don't know what it is. It's something we've been studying for well over 150 years. It basically defined psychiatry in its early days. And we still don't know what it is. It's a state of sort of calm and focus that induces a level of sense of suggestibility, basically. That's the simple definition, but there's a lot of wiggle room in exactly what that is. You can't recognize it on a brain scan. It's not something that you can spot, and it doesn't affect everyone the same. The difference between placebos, though, and hypnosis, one of them is placebos kind of come and go depending on your mood, depending on, you know, how you're feeling. Hypnosis seems to be more effective for certain people and affected throughout their whole lives. And then other people don't feel it at all, and they never can really access it. So there are things at work with hypnosis that are really interesting, but we still can't figure out what it is.
I have a hypnosis story. When I was giving birth, I was terrified of childbirth. The entire idea was not into it, but I had no choice. once you're there, you kind of have to. And I decided to look into hypnosis to help me with the, dealing with childbirth. So I found a hypnotist. She was a real weirdo. I would go to her house once a week with my husband, who was just like, I can't believe we're going to someone's house. It just she had 30 cats. It was a whole thing. But early on, I found out I was very suggestible. And I don't know what that says about me. Maybe you could tell me, but she, would put me in some sort of hypnotic state. And I'd be like, well, that was 30 seconds. And it turned out it was 15 minutes long or something. So, but we would practice this kind of going through childbirth and how childbirth doesn't have to be painful. And I was sort of retraining my brain. And I was really, really obsessed with it. But one of the things she had me do was lie down every day and picture what childbirth would be like walk myself through it. And every day I would sort of tell myself I was going to give birth 2 weeks early because I just couldn't bear the idea of waiting till the end because it just felt interminable. And my childbirth would be 5 hours long because that seemed like a good length to me. And then because I was lying down and I was pregnant, I would fall asleep. So every day I would try to walk myself through this and I'd get to 2 weeks early, 5 hours long, and I'd be out out cold every day. Anyway, I ended up giving birth 2 weeks early and the childbirth was 5 hours long.
Wow.
Exactly. Okay. And I can't say it was painless, but it was compared to other experiences I've heard, it seemed like it was a walk in the park.
That is a great example of something that is, it's sort of the sort of fruit that's dangled in front of scientists' faces when it comes to hypnosis. And it's very hard to study on in a controlled way, at least with the budgets that we have. These are the kind of questions were you affected by the hypnosis? What role did hypnosis play in your childbirth? That these are answerable questions that there's not enough people working on it to answer that question. And there are a lot of reasons to think, at least for the pain part of it, that hypnosis did have a big role to play, especially since you're highly hypnotizable. That's a huge thing. Did you ever get a number to go with that hypnotizability on the Stanford scale or one of the other scales?
No. How do you get a number?
That was going to be my question.
I'll do it right now. Hypnotize. Yeah.
So I should tell you right now that I am both bad at being hypnotized and bad at hypnotizing. I have tried to get better at both of them. There is a theory out there that you cannot become better at being hypnotized. There are other people who think that you can change that number. But if you find someone who's better at hypnosis than I am, and who is maybe a little more mainstream than the person you were going to.
Fewer cats, sure.
The cat lady. There are several scales. There's one that's used sort of more historically on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. The Stanford scale is the one I'm familiar with. 1 to 12, I think I'm somewhere around a 3. If you are 10 and up, I think is maybe 10% of the population, you're highly hypnotizable. There's all kinds of things that you can experience while under hypnosis that I can't, like memory loss, hallucinations, visual and audio hallucinations. I can make you hallucinate. As a 3, I can feel a little calm. I have a tough time getting in that state. And there's all these theories about why you are different from me. There's no good answers. They have looked.
I'm not just simpler. I have a simpler brain. A real basic.
No.
Rudimentary.
That's the stereotype that I got is that, people who are highly suggestible are dumber, for a lack of a better, that was always
that's what you've always said about me.
It's cruel. Behind your back and now to your face, and just I could tell that, this is why Alice would be hypnotized and, she would fall for Zach Morris's pranks. But is there any difference between that we know from the people who are highly suggestible in their, characteristics or their personalities versus people who aren't?
I mean, almost nothing. It's not intelligence. It's not age. People have looked at, and both with placebos and hypnosis, people have looked at personality types. They've looked at race. They've looked at gender. They've looked at all kinds of things. And it just doesn't seem to shake out as related to anything else. But what I can tell you is that, no, you are not gullible or dumber than I am. In fact, you're luckier than I am. In fact, I would love to have access to that kind of ability to manipulate my brain. I mean, it's an advantage more than anything else. And I tried like the Dickens to get there when I was working on my book, because it does open up a whole suite of opportunities to you in terms of treatments that I don't have. And your notion about like Zach Morris sort of like hypnotizing people is something that has held hypnosis back for a long time. And it carries a lot of baggage, which go back, we talk about like the history of hypnosis and why it's there. But to clear that up, you can't hypnotize someone against their will. That's not something you can do. Hypnosis is an agreement between the hypnotist and the person being hypnotized, and it's a partnership. So when you see people on stage doing stage hypnosis, you have to remember that part of that is actually stage tricks. You're actually seeing a combination of hypnosis and illusion, you know, that you'd see from Penn and Teller or anyone else. It's not straight hypnosis. Going in and like zapping someone's brain, that's an effect for Hollywood or for stage. That's not actually real hypnosis. And you can't get someone to, this is actually this great story from the late 1800s. One of the reasons why hypnosis got a bad rap, they got a bunch of bad press. And one of them was this guy who got hypnotized and then went and robbed a bank afterwards. And he got a ton of now, you know, that he, you know, the whole defense was, look, I got hypnotized and I robbed this bank, and it got tons of press. People talked about it all over the country. What no one talked about is the fact that guy was actually a professional bank robber. he got hypnotized beforehand. But like
minor details, Eric. Yeah, minor details.
He'd like robbed four other banks. Like this had nothing to do with him being hypnotized. Maybe he got more relaxed, you know, it's probably helpful for him robbing the bank, but like, you know, he used that as his defense, but like no one said that. So everyone had this picture of this guy like getting hypnotized and robbing a bank for someone else when really he was a criminal. And that's the kind of thing that I think people misunderstand about hypnosis is it's not like mind power. And it was sold that way for a long time, going back to the early days, but it's not the way it works. And if you can access that, if you have that ability, you do get a whole suite of treatment, especially for something like pain or anxiety. And that's what some of the overlap with hypnosis and placebo is, they do seem to affect similar things in the body. And those are things that who wouldn't want to have some mantra you could tell yourself to get rid of pain. I mean, that would be great.
Yeah.
And that's something you have that I don't have access to yet, unless I can get better.
I just wanted to feel smarter than Alice for one fleeting second.
You can't.
It felt good for that one moment. And then it
went. Once again.
You were there for a minute. Yeah.
I have emerged victorious once again.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Can you train yourself to be more hypno? That's not the right word.
Yeah, hypnotizable, I guess, would be the word to be looking for.
There you go. Thank you.
The common refrain is no, is that the hypnotizability you have when you're born is the hypnotizability you're stuck with. That hasn't been rigorously tested. Like many things, I mean, I had a hard time finding really good hypnosis researchers. And one of them, David Patterson at University of Washington, told me, yeah, some days he just gets sick of people sort of snickering at him behind his back, or, you know, even his face about like, oh, you study hypnosis. And, you know, and it's a hard field to go into because, you know, they are able to get good funding, but not many people are. And it does have this sort of, you know, Zach Morris, I actually look more to Dracula sort of history, mm-hmm. where Dracula can hypnotize you. And there's, it does have that sort of reputation, which makes it really hard to study. You don't have a lot of graduate students going into it and studying it. And yet it's this thing you know that you can measure, and it is a real effect in the brain, and it tells us a lot about the brain. But the notion of whether or not you can change your hypnotizability would need a lot of time and effort to really test out.
Yeah.
And the experiments are pretty easy to conceive of in your mind, but it would be hard to do. And it just hasn't really been done. So I've had several experts tell me, like, yeah, I think you can change it, move it up a little bit. But, you know, the basic understanding is that no, it's kind of what you get.
I was going to just ask for people who are listening who might be interested, if there are accredited hypnotists, if there's some sort of, you know, can they find people who might be trustworthy and not?
That's a great question. And yeah. I mean, I know you're going to get a bunch of hate letters, and please don't send them to me when I say this, but no. I mean, there isn't an accreditation organization the way we would think of it with medicine. There isn't a standard set of trainings you can do. There are different organizations that do accreditations, and there are different trainings you can get, but it's very hard to find a list of people who are sort of, you know, great hypnotists. And it's sad. It's the same thing because there should be, and because it is an interesting thing. And the skill of your hypnotist is a big part of whether or not it works, as I've proven, because I'm terrible at it. And so the one thing I tell people is, if you're going to go to a hypnotist, go to someone who has a degree to treat people in something else. So a psychotherapist, a psychologist, someone who could otherwise treat you and has experience in hypnosis. You will tend to get people who are more serious and have probably taken more time and who are more likely to know what not to do. You don't want to start monkeying around with memories and hypnosis. You want to be careful about the wording. Hypnosis, the words you use can be very suggestive, especially if you're very suggestible. Good hypnotists really, you know, there's books they publish about the kinds of words you use instead of other words while under hypnosis to communicate the kind of experience you want someone to have. So you're just more likely to find that with someone who already has a degree in some other field. So that's I guess the easiest thing to do is someone who's a psychotherapist and does hypnosis. That's all I can offer.
Would you recommend it in general, specifically for habit formation or breaking a habit? So I'm thinking of, you know, this time of year, people are setting their goals. And what if someone wanted to stop smoking, or if someone wanted to pick up a new habit? Like, is there anything clear about how it would affect breaking habits or habit formation?
Yeah.
And would you suggest it? What would you say to someone who was considering it?
I mean, I would say it's definitely in the suite of things that can be effective. And I don't think are placebos. I mean, I think you are really, you know, people often use it for phobias and for, you know, smoking cessation. That's been studied a fair bit. I won't say that the results are overwhelmingly like, oh, wow, this is amazing for this. But it's very hard to control for how high people are on the scales. And a lot of these studies, when you look at them, if you're very suggestible, you're kind of in a different world than someone who's not suggestible. And that's something that's hard to incorporate into the analyses. So when you look at the studies, it's not overwhelmingly encouraging, but it's definitely a powerful tool that I would try. And it can be. I mean, when it works, it works. That's the thing about hypnosis. You know, I have this story from the same scientist, David Patterson, told me. He had this guy who was in a burn unit. He basically had, you know, most of his body was burned. And I mean, you talked about childbirth. This woman I had spoken to who worked in the burn unit and also had children, she's like, yeah, there's no comparison between childbirth pain and burn pain. Like, it's the worst pain you can experience. This guy was in so much pain, they actually couldn't clean his wounds, his dressings. And the painkillers weren't working on him. Painkillers don't work on everybody. It's always a small group of people who don't respond. And so this hypnotist went in and he was like, okay, well, you know, let me try hypnosis. And the guy was, you know, like, you know, he was resistant, but he was like, look, you know, you got nothing to lose. Give it a shot. So finally said, okay, we'll try it. And it turned out this guy was highly hypnotizable. And they got to the point very quickly where they could roll this guy over, and he showed me a video, take off his bandages and scrub out all of these horrible burns where you could like see the nerves. And the guy was just staring off into space and felt nothing.
Wow.
And, you know, it was almost like a miracle. You're watching this thing, you can't believe it's happening. And the next day, he could try it on someone else and he'd get nothing. You know, he would just get, it just wouldn't work at all. And that's sort of the frustrating and fascinating parts of hypnosis. And so if you're in that category, if you're hypnotizable and you have a habit you're trying to kick, there's no way I wouldn't try it. Like, you know, Alice, if you've got something you're trying to, you know, kick or do or change.
What can I do now? I'm gonna become the perfect person.
I know.
I wish I could.
There's so many things I would try. You know, it may not work, but I think that for someone like you, it would be a much better option. But for someone like me, it's like, I might get some calmness out of it. You know, maybe I could get some tricks for managing urges, you know, and for like habits, like biting my nails or something like that. But I don't think it would be the same as if you went in.
All right, cool. And if you are hypnotizable, what do you think about self-hypnosis? Is that like, you know, tapes and audiobooks? Is that a worthwhile pursuit or is it better to have somebody guiding you through it?
I mean, most of the time, all the self-hypnosis, I mean, obviously it's better to have someone guiding you through it. It's better to be with someone who, you know, really knows what they're doing. There's a lot of question about the relationship between hypnosis and meditation. They don't seem to be the same thing. I always say hypnosis is sort of it's a form of expectation. Because it's more active. You know, I always say placebos are an expectation for the future. Like if I take this, this will happen. And hypnosis is an expectation for the present. Like, you know, when you're getting hypnotized, you're walking through a field of daisies and you feel the pain drift away from you, like, you know, like mist on a hot morning or whatever. And that's sort of, but they're both sort of using expectation and mechanisms in the brain to achieve a goal. Whereas your meditation really isn't built around that. And they don't seem to be the same in the brain. The brain is a really complex place, so it's really hard to say anything about what the brain's doing at any given time. You know, I always compare it to a football field, you know, and like trying to figure out like what's happening in the stands of a football field when, you know, it's packed and everyone's cheering and different people are doing different things. Like that's what the brain kind of is, except it's actually 1.2 million football fields. You know, it's just a lot going on. So when you're being hypnotized, the brain doesn't look the same. It's still doing a bunch of other stuff at the same time. So it's hard to know the difference between like something like hypnosis and meditation and self-hypnosis, but it is a good thing to do. You always want to be careful about what the suggestions are. You know, again, it's never good to mess with your memories or look for memories that you think are buried. I think when dealing with trauma, it's a dangerous thing to play with. When dealing with something like chronic pain or, you know, generalized anxiety or low-level depression, I think it's a really great tool. And it can be, especially if it works, if you feel it. You know, you do have to be careful, though. There have been some really tragic stories that have come out of hypnosis in terms of implanting memories in people. It's not without its risks. But self-hypnosis, you usually know what's going on. And if the messages resonate with you and the goals seem right,
And don't tell yourself that you should have a child in 5 hours because it turns out that's not enough time. Not enough time. That's
oh, really?
It's a wild ride. You got to account for commuting. I didn't account.
Well,
I was going to say, I don't know if this is a me thing or if this is a common thing, but I'm scared of hypnosis. Like the idea of handing over my suggestibility or my consciousness or something like that. Like that scares me away from wanting to try it, even though a significant part of me is curious about it. Like 49% of me is curious about it, but 51% of me is more afraid that, you know, something could go horribly wrong.
I would say that is exactly the most common sort of relationship with hypnosis that the average person has. I mean, that is exactly, I think, what most of us sort of feel. And a lot of that is frankly, it's given to us by culture. And actually, it kind of happened at one point sort of at the end of the previous century. So it's the beginning of the previous century, the early 1900s. Think about the movie Dracula. Or think about Dracula. Have you ever read Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember hypnosis coming into Dracula, the book?
I do not.
Someone used it. Do you remember who?
Was it Van Helsing? I just remember a lot of like,
yes,
waking up the next day and being faint and having...
Yeah, Van Helsing. Yeah. So the good guys used it.
Van Helsing was the only one who could have used it because he had like 17 PhDs or something like that.
They used it to find Dracula. By the time Dracula came out in the theaters, you know, sort of the classic black and whites, it was Dracula who was using it. Because in that time, hypnosis went from being this sort of like respected thing that doctors do to being a cult. And there were a number of people who were involved in this because there were a lot of really questionable scientists who just got very excited about hypnosis around the early 1900s and started, you know, looking for all kinds of wacky ghosts and things with hypnosis, and a lot of con men who are more than happy to, con men and women actually, more than happy to play along. And at the same time, it took on a very negative religious connotation. And in fact, many of the hypnotists I talked to, you know, when they'll talk about hypnotism, some people will literally put their fingers in a cross in front of themselves to ward off Satan, because it was around the early 1900s when some Protestant religion sort of decided that it was a satanic thing, and it had to do with some books that came out during that time. And so ever since then, it's kind of had this like negative, evil kind of, you know, if you watch cartoons, it's always the bad guys who have like spinning eyes.
Right.
And it's got this, yeah. And a lot of that comes
Jafar's snake staff.
Right. That, you know, and it just doesn't work that way. I mean, this is, you can't be hypnotized against your will. You, it's not a matter of will. And I think that was one of the things that the earliest hypnotist realizes, that the first one, Mesmer, really saw it as something he did to people. And, Later scientists sort of came to understand this was a relationship, and it was really something we do to ourselves more than anything else. It's really more about the person being hypnotized. So that might scare you more than anything else, like what you might do to yourself. But I don't think that stigma will ever really get shaken off hypnosis, but it doesn't, shouldn't be there. It's so interesting once you get into it.
Yeah. Jordan, I think we
that
need
is
to
really
do,
comforting.
I think we need to get you hypnotized for Lifehacker.
I, you know what? I do feel a lot better about it just having heard the historical context of like where it ended up getting this bad stigma, and a lot of what sort of went into what I can admit like and recognize now is my completely made up sort of pop culture influence take of what hypnosis would look like and what types of things are involved in it.
I mean, that's what, I mean, that's so much of expectation. It's so much of the, you know, my book is about the stories we tell ourselves. And a lot of those are given to us by culture. I mean, you can't separate from that. And hypnosis just got pulled a short straw, got a bad rap. And I mean, like the things you can do with it, I mean, in the 50s, there was this guy who made this, what's it called? Ichthyoformes. It's this sort of warts that form on your skin that look like fish scales. And they're really, really uncomfortable, and they bleed, and they're horrible. And he actually almost completely cured a kid of this using hypnosis. Like the skin, like it sloughed off like he was shedding like a snake. We don't know exactly how that happened, but like someone should be studying it. Like, so we should know, like, someone should be working on it. And it's very hard to do with the cultural connotations it has. And it's really a shame. But it's hard to look at some graduate student and be like, yeah, you should dedicate your life to hypnosis. You know, it's like, oh, the thing that the guy from Saved by the Bell does? No, not doing that. No, no, no.
Oh my goodness.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. This has been great.
Thanks so much for joining the show. Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad you guys had me. This was fun.
Time for our upgrade of the week, where we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Eric, what's your upgrade this week?
You know, it's actually a hopeful upgrade. I was recently told, I'm a big guy, I'm recently told I can't use my ankles for running anymore. It's not a great idea for me. So I need to get my heart rate up. And the thing I want to really get more than anything else is one of those boxing dummies. It's the best way to like just exhaust yourself and get out a lot of aggression. My favorite thing about the one that I was using is he just looks like someone you want to punch.
Just a punchable face on a boxing dummy.
It's just so much. He's got that sort of angry, you know, angry face of a high school bully. And I think if I had one of those, I could probably stay in a lot better shape.
I'm familiar with like the, you know, like the heavy bag and the speed bag, but not, there's an actual boxing dummy.
There's a person, he's got no arms. He's just this sort of like shirtless guy with a shaved head. And he's the bags are a little harder for me. Like I'm kind of a wimp, but there's just soft enough so that you feel like you're really like, you know, you're Rocky Balboa.
Just working this
yeah.
match.
And he's just the kind of guy just starts sneering at you, and you get on these like really thin gloves and you just go to town. And I think I have a lot of misplaced rage that I need to take out on one of those guys.
I mean, I think we all have a lot of well-placed rage. We need something to, you know, punch responsibly. That sounds awesome. I love it.
Love that.
Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
I am going the other way, and I'm going to talk about a recent Christmas gift I got that has changed my life, and it is the weighted blanket. And I think this has come up before on the podcast from other people as an upgrade. And I was always like, it seems nice, whatever. I mean, it sounded like a comfortable thing, but it is in fact life-changing. It's the greatest thing ever. If you, as I do, enjoy when you go to the dentist, the kind of lead apron thing they put over you for the, for, you know, when you get the x-rays, you needed a weighted blanket in your life. It is amazing. It's just,
I love that lead blanket.
It's
love
so
it.
Comforting in a way that I just didn't know it would be. It's like, it's just like this pressure and it's.
Do you sleep under it or is it like for.
I use it for naps. So it's not quite big enough for me and my husband, and he wants to share it with me. And I'm like, no, all for me. So
no,
it's just,
no.
You get more of the weight on you if it's all you. So I've really kept it to like the weekend nap. It's perfect. Also good just for putting around your, I'm now like, now that everything is, you know, long distance or tele appointments, whenever I have a therapy session, put the weighted blanket on my lap. It's like,
just,
it's so great.
Yeah. I want one of those to just crush me to death. I really.
It's surprisingly heavy.
Jordan, you might want to talk to someone about that. That's actually. Right.
This might be a problem. Yeah. This might be just crush me to death with a weighted blanket. That's the way I want to go. That's how I want to go out in this world.
It's amazing. They say in the crucible, you know, more weight is the last thing you'll ever say. Yeah, the guy they're crushing out of the rocks. Do you have anything to say? And he says, more weight.
More weight.
Jordan, how about you? What's your upgrade?
All right. So my upgrade this week comes courtesy of one of my really good friends, Alessandro, who is from Georgia. And if you're familiar, keeping up with politics right now, you know that there is this big election in Georgia. And what the lead up to that election meant for him being from Georgia and having a Georgia area code is a million robocalls. Like he had so many calls from all of these different I don't know how they get your number, maybe with your voter registration, but you end up with a ton of robocalls about politics and who you should vote for and all that. And he wouldn't answer the phone, but he would still get a ton of voicemails because they will just leave robo voicemails. My upgrade, and this is something that I've done for a while, and I would highly recommend it for anyone who does not like voicemails, is to just don't activate your voicemail or deactivate it. Like, don't have voicemail set up at all as an option. And a lot of people will have voicemail messages that say, you know, don't bother leaving a voicemail, or their voicemail box will just end up filling up until no one can leave a voicemail anyway. But if you keep people from having the option of leaving voicemails, then it won't waste their time because they won't hear that message that your voicemail box is full and they won't be able to leave you a message. The phone will just ring until I don't even know what happens. I've never called myself, but like it'll ring until it just stops. And then they don't get a chance to leave a voicemail. Or maybe I think it gives a message saying this person's voicemail box is not set up. And they know to text you then. They don't even need an explanation of what to do. They just know what should follow. There's other ways of getting in touch with me. So if you hate voicemail, just don't have your voicemail set up and problem solved.
But then you won't get the telemarketers telling you that, you know, the IRS is coming to your home, and
that's the only thing I'm missing out on. Yeah, that's all I'm missing out on are the latest medical rates that I could be getting, and who I should be voting for, and maybe like a Nigerian prince or two. I've missed out on some of those great business opportunities.
Oh my
but
gosh.
Otherwise, I think my ignorance has been bliss. It's been really good not having voicemail.
I have a buddy, Greg Wingren, if you're out there, who. It was the master of leaving really long rambling voicemails. And while at the time they're really annoying, I do kind of miss them. You know, I haven't talked to him in a while. I do miss his just like, you know, 10-minute voicemails.
Just nostalgia, just turned on like a podcast in the background.
Yeah.
It's like he's right here with me.
Well, Jordan, I leave very, very good long rambling messages and you're never going to get to enjoy them.
You can send me a voice memo.
That's
another alternative. Yeah. If you just want to send me a long, rambly message, there are still ways.
Okay.
There are still ways.
All right, fair enough.
And I will appreciate them.
All right. Well, thank you so much again, Eric.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Thanks for coming, Eric. Really enjoyed having you.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Brad Fisher.
start our year off by rating us on Apple Podcasts. You can leave us a review, and you can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving us a voicemail. Or, of course, you can write us an email at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.